welcome everyone to episode number 3 of Talking Shop Down Under. Tonight we've got Joe Al-Bahari with us. How are you, Joe?
I'm great, thanks, Richard.
Excellent. How are you? I'm very well. And apparently third time's a charm for episode 3, so you're the one that's going to make this whole thing an absolute roaring success. So, Joe, by way of a background, do you want to give us a bit of a rundown on yourself and where you fit into the world?
Sure. I've been programming since I was 15, you know, on an Apple II, and I absolutely loved it back then. You couldn't keep me away. And it's still like that today. I love programming. I've been doing it now for more than 20 years. I've been into C# since it came out, and I'm a C# MVP. And I've written some titles for the O'Reilly in the Nutshell series, C# 3 and 4 in a Nutshell, and some of the pocket references. And in the last few years, I've also written LinkPad, commercialized that last year. And now that's pretty much all I'm doing is writing books and working on LinkPad as a kind of as a full-time job.
Well, so you're not actually out in the field talking to the unwashed masses anymore?
No, I've pretty much given that up. And, it's partly due to I'm actually doing some training around town. I'm doing a bit of training consulting, but it's partly thanks to the people who've used LinkPad and they've registered it, that they bought the product, and that's created an income stream. And thanks to that, I've been able to basically keep away from the contract market and use that time for developing LinkPad and new versions and so on.
Oh, excellent. So the authoring doesn't actually keep you off the streets?
The authoring, it actually doesn't make an awful lot of money because piracy is quite rampant nowadays with books, and we don't quite make what we used to, but LinkPad does a lot better than in terms of revenue than the book, certainly. If it wasn't for that, I would be on the streets. Yeah.
Standing in the corner with a little can in your hand. Hello, I need money. I'm a poor starting developer.
Yes, absolutely.
So you started with the Apple II, did you?
Yeah. Do you remember the Apple II?
Oh, yeah.
It was so much fun. Like, it was in the days where you could understand everything about that computer, about every bit of software that ran on it. It was simple enough. It was lovely.
I actually started with the infamous Commodore 64 myself.
Ah, right. That was a competing
computer. Oh, yeah, it was. It was very much the us and them at that point.
It was, yeah.
You don't still have yours, do you?
No. I'm unfortunately, we gave it away, yes. Do you still have your 664?
No, mine blew up. It was very sad, but I kind of, for a while there, I was building up the whole little museum collection. So I had the Amiga and I had all the old PCs through the years, 386, the 486, the laptop.
Yes, you can get simulators as well for them if you're really a diehard fan.
I've got one, so shh.
I won't tell anyone. Don't worry.
It goes great. It's excellent. You were saying you've done some books recently, C# 4.
4 in a Nutshell, which is an update of 3. And it's just like 3 in a Nutshell, but it's another 200 grams. So it's actually, we've broken the 1 kilo barrier on that book now, which is partly because the framework's just got so big that, and we don't even do the whole framework. We do the CLR and some of the BCL and the language, but even it's quite a lot of, it becomes quite big nowadays. So
you're not touching Entity Framework at all in the book?
Only briefly, like we mentioned, Entity Framework in terms of like we describe, how do you do real world link queries that hit a database? For us, that's really important, and that means we have to do a little bit on Entity Framework in order to do that. But we don't go into any detail because to do that, that's like a whole 1,000-page book just Entity Framework alone.
Well, yeah, especially if it was the first one.
Yeah.
That's a nasty thing that was.
Oh, yeah.
So what are some of the things you cover in .NET 4 now?
In .NET 4, there's obviously the new language enhancements, and then it's dynamic programming, optional and named parameters, PAM, PLINK, and TPL, which is the new parallel programming libraries. Those are pretty cool. They kind of simplify multi-threading, and they're very tuned also towards parallel programming, which is making use of all these multi-calls now that we've we're getting now at least like four cores or hyper-threaded four core processors, and this makes it quite easy to leverage all of that that new exciting new hardware. And there's also code contracts in there.
Yeah,
and
love that.
Oh yeah, you're using that?
When I can.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's quite good overall. It's there's also the new security, the transparency model and the CLR, which is relevant to kind of a small section of developers. But if you need it, then it's essential to kind of have a really easy to understand explanation that gets you up to speed quickly. Because a lot of this information that you can read in books, you can find it on the net. It's just it might take you 3 hours to the time when you first start looking, to the time when you actually have a good understanding of the topic, versus maybe, you know, half an hour or 1 hour. And so that, like, you know, you've wasted 2 or 2.5 hours. For a lot of people, they can't afford that time. You know, people want and the pain of that time, because that's kind of a painful learning process where you're reading a lot through a lot of noise and you're filtering stuff and there's some misinformation or very wordy explanations. So it's kind of what we've done is condense it down, just like, what do you really want to know, like, to get to that, to the core of that understanding quite quickly.
And then quite a few people will be in places where, for whatever reason, blogs are actually blocked by the corporate firewall, which is just painful.
Really? I never knew that. No way.
Oh, yeah.
And they're worried people might enjoy reading the blog, so they block it. They'll enjoy the filter there.
I know people that actually do, because of the corporate firewall stuff, they actually have to do all their looking up of everything else for work when they get home. So basically they'll go home, look up all their stuff, put it on a USB stick, realize they can't do that. They have to write it down by hand because they can't plug the USB stick in, come back into work. Oh, it's just crazy.
No, I hope these corporate firewalls block the pirate copies of our book.
So actually, are you going to distribute it on Amazon, go for the Kindle and things like that at all?
It's on Amazon. The printed copy's on Amazon. You can buy the PDF on O'Reilly. I don't know whether there's a dedicated Kindle version or not, although you can read PDFs on Kindle.
So, yeah, I kind of see that'll be quite a change for the way things will work. Out of curiosity, how did you fall into writing?
Into writing books.
Authoring, sorry, if that's
better. Yes, it's in fact, it was my brother who used to work for Microsoft, and he had connections, and he was one of the authors on the original C# in a nutshell and C# Essentials. And then when it came to the new version, it just got too much. So he asked me if I was interested in doing that, and I had a look at the old format of the book, and I realized it was very dated, and it was based on listings of members, which I kind of predicted correctly what people will no longer be interested in, what with IntelliSense and the internet and so on. So I did quite a radical restructure on that, and the editors were very happy with it. So it sort of went from there.
Okay, and then from there you've just branched out slowly into other things.
Yeah, that's right. You can't keep you away from programming. I love it too much. People tell me I need to get out more.
I think they'd tell anyone that, wouldn't they? That's what we do for a living. We're all nerds. We got to live in our little caves and not go out. Got, you know, that fluoro tan to look after and everything else.
That's right.
So one of the things you mentioned in terms of new features in .NET 4 is the dynamic keyword. So in Redify, just chatting to some of the guys internally, there's kind of mixed opinions on this. Some people think it's great. Some people think it's just meh. What's your take on it?
My take mostly is with the latter. It's mostly meh. It's that there are a few very valuable niche scenarios which it works really well. And one of them is, and it's, I think, a little known feature, is that dynamic gives you what's called multiple dispatch. And what that basically means is that member overload resolution happens at runtime rather than compile time, if you cast any of the arguments to dynamic, and that can be really useful. So have you heard of the visitor pattern?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the more unintuitive, complicated patterns, design patterns. I don't know what you think about it, but for me, like to this day, you know, like when I see an accept method, I always struggle a little bit with that. And with dynamic with dynamic binding, you can basically you can implement the visitor pattern using multiple dispatch, which simplifies it so much. It's actually totally simple and intuitive, the whole thing. And to me, that's probably that's the most the thing I'm excited about most with dynamic, to be honest. There's in other areas, the other thing that I was very excited about was the idea of having really low coupling. Like you want two systems to talk to each other but make no assumptions about any CLR type information. Like we know how bad it is at the moment. Like if let's say you build a program and it references an assembly and it's a strong named assembly, and then you rebuild that assembly with a different version number. You just change that last digit by one, and then straight away you plug that assembly back into your main application. It doesn't work anymore unless you rebuild your main application. So now sometimes it's a good thing because that's exactly what you want, right? You only want your application to work against a known version of something else. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you want low coupling systems where you just want to work with anything as long as it has an interface or classes with these members. Now, I was quite excited that Dynamic would make that easier, because without Dynamic, the alternative is reflection, which is pretty painful. But that the problem with Dynamic is you can't call members of interfaces dynamically, because mm-hmm. if the interface member is implemented explicitly, there is no way to get at it through dynamic binding. So now interfaces, to me, are the things you're going to use most if you want very low coupling.
You would hope so.
Yeah, exactly. So to me, yeah, there's very little left in terms of good uses for dynamic. Okay, you've got interoperating with dynamic languages, and even then, there's an awful lot you can do without actually needing dynamic binding. And the other is a cominterop, and again, there's an awful lot you can do in CLR4 without actually using dynamic binding. It doesn't actually help you that much. So to me, the main thing is multiple dispatch and these few little niche scenarios like numeric type unification. There's a few things that we cover in the book where it is actually comes in pretty handy, but most of the time, no, I wouldn't use it. I would be with static typing. I mean, there's people who say dynamic typing is good because there's all these dynamic languages which are so cool, and they're more productive than us because they don't have to worry about types. I programmed for 7 years in a duck typed, dynamically typed, object-oriented language. I would never want to go back. Static typing has such immense benefits.
Did you want to name and shame that language?
I would say that it's three letters. It's an acronym with three letters. The first one is V, okay, and it's got the word fox in it somewhere. And the language wasn't that bad at the time.
Is it no longer supported by Microsoft?
It's no longer supported by Microsoft. And it's but to be fair, I mean, the competitors at the time, there was VB, right, which I wouldn't say that was any better at all. There was Delphi. I'd say maybe that was a better language than the one I haven't named in shame.
Do you want me to do it for you?
And the biggest problem I found with dynamic typing is when your system gets beyond like a 10-line program, like any real world system, and you want to refactor something. Like the great thing about C# is you want to do a lot of refactorings, the IDE will do the whole thing for you, right? That can never happen in dynamic languages. But moreover, with more complicated refactorings, if you don't do the job, if you only partly refactor, the compiler tells you, hey, you know, this member doesn't exist anymore. Great. So you go over and you fix it over here, and your compiler again comes up with another three errors. Hey, you've not fixed this over here. And then by the time you got the whole thing to compile, right, you've got almost all, if not all, of the bugs out. Like the compiler's, and you can confidently change things. I'm always changing member names, property names, making them better name, more meaningful, changing methods to properties, refactoring stuff into classes. Like you've got to do that. Otherwise, your code base just goes downhill. And I found that was so difficult in dynamic languages. I would just dare change anything.
So I'd be interested to hear some Ruby guys come back and combat that one. Be interesting.
Yeah. Having said that, I mean, there are niche scenarios for dynamic languages, and I certainly wouldn't deny that. I'm talking about the mainstream scenarios, but if they want to argue that there's certain scenarios where it's better, I'm sure that they could win that argument, because certainly on the scripting side and with JavaScript and stuff like that, I mean, sometimes it's more hassle than it's worth, a type system.
So from a an integration point, do you see there's going to be a lot of static languages talking to dynamic languages going on, or using dynamic for just, I suppose, embeddable scripting engines, calling out to those engines as part of, say, a calculation engine or something happening in an application?
Yeah, sure.
And then bring it back in?
That's one of the things that dynamic languages are good for. Like, if you want to write a rules engine, okay, well, let's first go back a step and say, well, given that C-sharp's a dynamic language, why can't we write a rules engine in C-sharp? And the answer is that it's only partly dynamic. You can't actually execute a string in C-sharp 4. So if you want to execute a string, then you need to use something like Ruby or Python. And then, yeah, you can use the interop. I've tried it. It's actually amazingly easy to get it working, and you can get that up and running very quickly. And in fact, if I wanted to write a rules engine right now, I would just go straight for IronPython, and I would start writing it in IronPython, and it's great for that.
I'd be interested to see the Iron Ruby implementation. Have you played with that much at all?
I've not touched that. You know, I'm pretty ignorant with Ruby, and I've just played briefly with Python and looked at that.
That's fair enough. Okay, so you mentioned earlier, just at the top of the show, that you're responsible for this small little utility called LinkPad, which I think just about everyone on the planet has downloaded at one point or another. It makes for an interesting story, I think, in terms of how you can start off with just something that's quite simple and then have that build up into something that can turn into a revenue stream. Do you want to just talk about how that happened?
Yeah, sure. I think that one of the most important things is that you start off getting into the community into which you'll eventually be selling. And I kind of did this by accident, in that I love Link, and I was contributing on the Link forums and programming it and writing books on it. And then it just occurred to me that there needed to be some utility to let you to interactively query in Link. And so I wrote that utility, and because I've already I knew people on the Link forum, and at that stage, there also, because it was a germination project, there were a lot of influential people on that forum, people from Microsoft, and then when I posted on there, they read that and they downloaded it themselves and they played with it and they liked it. And I think it's important when you're writing something like that to get a product that captures all of the essential ingredients that make it a viable proposition, a viable utility, without getting carried away with too much detail. So, I mean, the original one, it took less than 3 months to write, and it actually had just an ordinary, like, rich text box as the editor, mm-hmm. and that was it. And it was pretty basic, but it did the essential things that created that the need for the product to exist. And that was the important thing, because I got first to market and got the user base and then worked on the user base and invited feedback, listened to all the feedback, made more enhancements and updates. And it does help that the market into which I the market that I'm in is a market I'm very familiar with. I use this myself. I dog food it. I use it all the time for LinkPad. And LinkPad is it's grown. It's not just now for Link queries, but it's a C-sharp scratch pad or a VB scratch pad. So you can type any C-sharp VB expression, statements, or a whole program in there, run it, and just get this instant feedback. It's kind of almost like a read, evaluate, print loop, but it's like an instant feedback console for any C-sharp code. And I do that all the time now. If I'm writing anything, I do half my code. I write it first in LinkPad, and I reference any assemblies I need. I get it working, and then I just paste it into Visual Studio, and it works. And I think when you dog food something like that, you get a product that's actually useful and that people are going to use.
So one of the things that normally happens when people come up with a little idea, because LinkPad being just a little utility at the start, was it the intent to always do something commercial with it? Because a lot of people, I suppose, would have started it and they would have just gone, oh, you know what, let's just throw it up on Codeplex and and use that because of, you know, and then open source it, and then after that, opportunity gone.
Exactly. Yes, it's difficult to know what to do with something, and I have open source stuff before, and I think that's great. With this one, I thought I would give it a go to try and commercialize the auto completion feature. And it was lucky that there was actually a feature that I could add onto it that was sufficiently useful that people would pay extra for it, and that is viable for doing that.
But this wasn't the intent from the start, or it was?
No. Originally, it was just an altruistic venture completely from the start. Mm-hmm. It was just later that I thought, well, if I can get a revenue stream from adding this extra thing, then I can afford to put a lot more time into developing it in the future. And it was a fun project. I love working on it.
So one of the interesting things, I was at your Tech Ed session in the Gold Coast when you talked about this sort of thing, was how you figured out what price to sell things at.
Sure. It's an interesting thing with pricing. In fact, I was just thinking today, actually, there's a couple of ways you can do it with, look at most .NET utilities. They sell for a few hundred dollars, you can get into that end of the market, and everything's good. But I really wanted to get into the low end with a high volume. And the big problem with getting with the low end of the market is that if you get a lot of people pirating your software, then the money you get from a few honest people paying $30 is just not going to amount to anything. So you need an activations-based licensing system to do that. And so and that was a very interesting project because I really didn't know how it would work out and how people would react to it, because you don't often have a $30 product with an activations-based licensing. And there were some interesting things I discovered from doing that. But, I mean, the big advantage is of putting in activations-based licensing, and this is something that applies to piratable stuff like utilities, is that you can actually aim for the $30 end of the market and do well out of it. And without that, I mean, there's no way I would put $30. It would be in the $300 end of the market. So you can make things literally 10 times cheaper if you can get a good system to minimize piracy.
Any tips on how that works? You know, with the keys to the kingdom, for instance.
I can give people a lot of tips if they contact me. But there's a lot of useful things. Like, for instance, if you're going to lock things down to the hardware, I've for years I've experimented with various things to use, and there's good things and there's bad things. And if anyone is doing this, they're free to contact me, and I'll tell them the good things and the bad things to lock it down to.
All right, but we won't broadcast it at the moment.
Yeah, we'll do that.
All right, so that $30 price mark, how did you end up arriving at that? Because I know you talked about higher prices, lower prices, and just trying to find that medium where people would be comfortable paying something.
You can experiment a lot with the prices, and the way to do it is people don't like a schizophrenic prices, but what you can do is you set your base price a little bit higher on the higher side, and then you just vary the discounts and experiment with different discounts. People love discounts; they love special offers. Have you ever been to the Dell website to buy a laptop or something? There's always a special offer on, and it always ends this week, right? But at the end next week, that there's another special offer on. It may be as good as the special offer on that's now. It may not be. And that's the thing. If you keep always have a special on, but you change it regularly, then people know that there may be another special on next month, but it may not be as good as this one. It creates a sense of urgency because we all have busy lives, and we often irrationally delay purchase decisions. So you need to create a reason not just to buy the product, but to buy it now. And a great way to do that is with special offers. And you can do it with discounts, but you can also do it with small, shiny objects. Like anything extra that you can give away, like a virtual activation pack, or you can give away free updates in the future. And there's various other things you can do to make give people the very realistic idea that the end of this month or whatever, that offer's going to end, and then there may or may not be another offer the next month. And I mean, I never resort to misleading or exaggerating or lying to people. And partly because it's going to cause you trouble in the long term. But also, I mean, part of what's nice about setting up your own business is you can do everything in a wholesome way. You don't have to resort to any of that. And to me, I like doing that. I like creating a relationship with my customers and looking after them. And it's the whole thing. I like it to be a fun project as well as a money-making project.
So if I'm just a average developer out there and I get this little idea, I'll go create a utility, that whole idea of then promoting and setting prices and just getting in that headspace of adding urgency to a site can be kind of I suppose intimidating or uncomfortable at times for people. Have you got any tips in terms of that? Did you find that yourself when you were doing it?
Actually, I really enjoyed it. To me, it was you experiment and you try things and then you measure. I mean, you measure your conversion is the number of sales divided by the number of downloads. So it's very easy to gather data. And there's obvious. I've not read actually. I should probably have read more books on this. I'm not really very good at doing that. I'm really bad at such a bad thing. I'm really bad at that. So, but yeah, there's good books out there, and there's lots of other websites. Like one thing I noticed is that what nearly everyone seems to do is that whenever you're buying a product, even if it's like you're buying this electronic download, there's a picture of a three-dimensional box there. You know, I don't know why they do that.
That's bizarre, isn't it?
There's even a website where you can upload like the JPEGs off the front and the side images of the box. It creates the box for you.
Is that like the Web 2.0 logo generator?
It's something like that, yeah. It's amazing.
Oh, very good. So getting over that uncomfortable, you didn't find that yourself?
I find it was actually quite fun, the marketing, because with a product like this, you spend most of your time programming and you put some aside for marketing. And it's a nice balance. I mean, if I was 100% time, all I was doing with marketing, I kind of find that boring. But you know, it's nice doing a bit of that. It's I find that's a kind of like nice light relief.
Okay, so from a self promotion point of view, I suppose this is the other side of marketing. So it's one thing to have a product out there that becomes well known and things like that, but you also have to do other things to keep your name in front of people.
Yeah, sure.
How do you go in terms of that side of, the networking and making the right contacts and knowing who to talk to so that you can do things like the LinkedIn.net user group you just did recently?
Sure. Well, doing something like writing a book, that's really helpful. That creates a lot of openings, and then they also create more openings for you through that. And speaking at TechEd's good, an MVP, that's good, it creates more openings. And you concentrate on the things you enjoy doing, and you just keep pushing that and put some time aside for it. I find also a useful tip is that when you do start selling your product is to make sure that you'll get people's email addresses when they purchase, but make sure that you put a checkbox which allows people to opt in to going on your mailing list so you can tell them about any updates on new products you got. And I've done that myself. I find 50% of people will check the box, and then you've got a totally legitimate captive audience, thousands of people that you can email out if you've got some new venture you want to do, or you've got a new update, you've got some new ideas and you want to get some feedback on that.
Okay, very good. In terms of one thing though, you don't need to be an MVP and you don't need to be an author to be able to do this sort of thing. It's
sure.
It's just
if you get involved, you find the forums. Where do your customers hang out? And that's the first thing. Where do they hang out online? And then you join those places. You find out about your customers as well, which is great. And you can also from that point you'll get the answers as to what you need to do once you mingle and are part of that community.
Mm-hmm. And just one other thing, that 3 months you said writing LinkPad in the first place, that wasn't 3 months full time. I assume you had another job at the same
time. I had another job, but it was equivalent. Probably it was equivalent of maybe 2 months full time, spread over maybe 4 months or something like that.
And just a few late nights and pizzas. Yeah, see, I mean, the thing is that, like that.
Yeah, when you're enjoying something, like time flies, isn't it?
Oh, it does.
when you're doing a tedious data migration project, it just like every hour counts.
Ah, so now we understand. You were doing this while doing a data migration project. cat's out of the bag.
Right.
All right, Joe. I think we're just about getting to time. So anything else you want to throw out there? What are you working on at the moment?
Sure. I'm doing the next update for LinkPad. There's a whole lot of new enhancements to auto completion. So, and part of it's is parity with VS 2010 with its auto completion. And there's also some very cool things that they haven't yet come up thought of, that Microsoft have not thought of. And so hope that they might be stealing these ideas for VS 2012.
I think they just look at ReSharper, don't they, and copy that?
Probably. Yes, another thing I've been on my list to do and I haven't had time for. So, yes. And someone's asked me to write a manual for LinkPad. One person has asked me to write a manual. Like, who reads manuals? I might even consider doing it if I didn't read it.
You could do put code in this box.
Yeah.
Done.
Yeah, I'm thinking of discoverability. Feature discoverability is the thing I'm working on in lieu of a manual. People hopefully find it.
But tooltips or well-named menu items.
Yeah, exactly.
It's genius stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe what you really need is a start button.
Yes, a start button.
And then maybe an animated paperclip.
Yeah, it looks like you want to write a query. Would you like to bollocks it up for you?
It's genius.
I'll work on that.
He says, no, I won't. All right, Joe, excellent. Thanks for your time.
Great. And thanks, Richard.
We'll leave it there. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Talking Shop Down Under. We'll see you next time.